Hello, I'm Donovan Bigelow, and this is the opening lecture in a series on adolescent development. And I got to say right off the bat that this one is different. I'm exhausted. I was frustrated putting this together. I was researching data, and it seemed to be all over the map. It was optimistic, it was pessimistic, it was contradictory. There were moments when I was excited about the material and moments when I just wanted to throw it all in the waste paper basket. And then it hit me rather recently as I'm putting this rather lot of material together. Wait a minute, that's exactly what adolescent development is about. That's exactly what it feels like to be an adolescent, up and down, left and right. Wait a minute, it's exactly what it feels like to be the parent of an adolescent. And I thought, there's something about this material that seems unique, and my sense is that it's going to evoke a great deal of very primitive emotions, fear and anxiety and anger and frustration, hopes and desires and dreams and all of that all mixed up. My hope is that this material will manage to give some sense to what seems like chaos. And I'm hoping that adolescents that listen to this will be able to turn a little of the chaos within them into understanding. And my hope is that parents who see chaos in their children will recognize that there is chaos in themselves as well, and they're seeing as much as of their own chaos as they are that of their children as they attempt to parent them. So, mainly, this lecture series is an impassioned plea for parents to reevaluate their own issues and their understandings and approaches to their own teenagers and to their parenting styles. Half of my patients are between 11 and 22 years old, easily, and without exception, the teenagers I see in my office are in my office because their parents are reenacting the parents' own childhood conflicts and experiences and inflicting their own derailed development, developmental processes onto their children, and it's not working. And what's terribly painful and terribly ironic almost is that the adults I see, and my patients range in age from mid-20s to mid-60s, what I see consistently is the same things. That my adult patients are still struggling with adolescent issues with their now very much older adults, adult parents. It's sad, it's tragic when my patients in their 40s, 50s, and 60s are struggling with issues with their parents in their now 70s, 80s, and sometimes early 90s that feel like little more than adolescence reenacted. And the worst part of that is when I see the older parents, the grandparents, now the great-grandparents, I get reports from their children in my adult practice, and it does seem as if the parents remained oblivious to their children's, now adult children's, experience as young children and as adolescents. And it would be a tragedy if parents today of adolescents ended up reenacting that experience down the road. It is my sincere hope that this material will be some amount of useful in that derailing of what we call the intergenerational transmission of trauma. It's clear that you can look at parents' behavior in terms of their adolescent parenting, and we can blame the parents. But then we can't really blame the parents because, of course, the grandparents really started it. Wait a minute, that isn't true either. What about the great-grandparents? And how far do we have to go back? My sense now is that if parents today do not make every effort to explore what's going on inside of them, their issues, their histories, reevaluate their approach to their children like the parents of my older patients, you're going to lose them. It isn't necessary. It isn't inevitable. I think also this probably isn't the kind of opening statement you expected to hear on a lecture series about adolescent development. Now I'm talking about the parents. But it turns out that the issues remain astonishingly similar. And I want to take all the blame away. If you don't get this part of my opening statement, then none of the rest of it's going to be tolerable. In my approach to psychotherapy with teenagers, younger patients and my adult patients. There is no blame. There can't be, because that just results in evocative resistance and anger and frustration and the projection of hostility, and everything simply remains the same. The goal of this exercise and the goal of good therapy is to generate a sense of understanding. I think we have responsibility, but I'm going to juxtapose these two ideas, and I'm going to be as clear as I can about them. There is responsibility on the part of the parents to parent their children in accordance with the needs of the adolescents and the children so that they grow up to be healthy and strong individuals. It is also the parents' responsibility to have the courage and the strength to look inside themselves to make sure they can do that by making the repair, by making the changes in themselves that will allow them to do that. If they didn't get dealt a fair hand by their parents or grandparents, which is frankly the case most of the time, then it's up to them, you, to stop the intergenerational transmission of trauma, which is a fancy psychological way of saying that the stuff rolling downhill has got to stop at some point, and you know what, why not now? Here's the good news. I find working with adolescents easier than working with adults for two reasons. One is adolescents remain passionate. They remain excited most of the time. They still have this sense of aliveness that hasn't been crushed out of them. They still have hope, and they still have a sense of flexibility. They know they're not done growing yet, and they want to learn things. And so most of them, over some resistance, clearly, often, I get that, but most of them still have a little spark of aliveness that's just under the surface that a good therapist can access and make use of. In addition to that, adolescents are a little bit easier to achieve because the traumas they've experienced, there aren't so many of them, perhaps. I can't say that they're not less important, because a childhood trauma is profound and powerful and stays with us our life long. But it's one thing to treat the traumas of a 15-year-old. It's an entirely different matter to treat the traumas of a 50-year-old. And the part that makes that difficult is not just that there's more of them. It's that the 50-year-old has already made most of his or her serious life decisions. They've channeled themselves down a particular career path. They've made choices about marriage and children and divorce and remarriage. And all of the big decisions in life by 50 or 60 have, in effect, already been made. If those decisions didn't work out well, then there is a profound amount of grieving to be done, which makes a therapeutic process very difficult. It's still necessary in order to have a loving, joyous life, or as much of that as you can. One still has to find the courage to do the grieving at whatever point in time in life therapy makes sense. And I don't have the slightest doubt in my mind that in my field, better late than never is absolute truth. So with that sort of recognition of the difficulty of the problem and basic optimism about what can be done, the plan for these series of lectures is fairly straightforward. I have an introductory material, section one, introduction. I want to spend section two talking about what is understood generally to be the normal trajectory of adolescent development. Section three are the various pathologies, what can go wrong and why. And not surprisingly, section four is going to be on the therapy with adolescents and their families. It should be obvious by now that there can be no meaningful therapy of adolescents alone. We'll talk more about that later. It is a family dynamic. It is a team effort always, and we'll get to that. All right. More of the introductory material to begin with. The emotional life of an adolescent has three overlapping and interrelated elements. The first is biology. There is an explosion of sex hormones and maturational dynamics and growth across the board, and an adolescent's got to deal with that one way or the other. There are the ubiquitous family dynamics. The adolescent doesn't just grow up. He or she must be raised, and they're always raised in a family dynamic with a history and the adolescents simply cannot be taken out of that family dynamic and treated independently. If I can't get the parents involved directly in the therapy of the adolescent, it very likely will fail, quite frankly. What become the third part of this important adolescent developmental trajectory is peer groups and the cultural context. I don't want to leave that out. Most good researchers on adolescent development recognize that the child in latency, and that's from 6 to puberty, that remains a time when the child remains dependent primarily on the family. Peer groups start developing, friends start being developed, that's true, but it remains primarily a dependency relationship on the nuclear family. With the rise of adolescence, the peer group become a substitute for the family, and in many cases, in terms of the adolescent's growing sense of identity, as are more important than the family, and parents have to recognize that the adolescent pulling away from them and turning toward outsiders is a perfectly normal and, in fact, necessary developmental progression. The primary developmental mission of every adolescent, and I think this is the universal truth. If you take nothing else away from these lectures, focus on this. The primary developmental mission of every adolescent is the creation of an adult identity separate from the parents. That's it. The fundamental goal of every young adolescent is the creation of a new identity built on the bedrock of the family dynamics, built on the childhood developmental events. There's no question about that. He doesn't become a new and separate person entirely. But the key development is the achievement of a sense of self that is independent to a degree of the parental configuration. So Bobby is no longer little Bobby, son of Mr. and Mrs. Smith, or Julie, son, daughter of Mr. and Mrs. Smith. That identification as I am a child of these parents begins to fairly quickly be attenuated. And the child struggles in a frequently quite painful struggle to separate from the parents in terms of that internalizing sense of self and to see themselves more and more as little Bobby or little Susie, now becoming bigger Bobby and Susie, Robert and Susan, and they are now independent of the parents, at least in fantasy to some degree. And that is an appropriate, and it's painful for the kids, and it's also painful for the parents quite frequently. And this is where there's a great deal of friction. Independence can look to a parent a lot like disrespectful rebellion. And we're going to spend some time talking about how to tease that apart. Part of the difficulty in putting this lecture together, and part of what I see with my patients, both teenagers and their parents, is that this is really hard. That growing into a young adult, that dealing with the hormones and the sexuality, the budding sexuality, and sometimes the overt sexuality of teenagers, it's hard on the teenagers, it's hard on the parents. Teenagers aren't very good at it. Parents sometimes aren't very good at handling the teenagers' tumultuous efforts at autonomy. It brings out everything primitive in both parties. You know, and you put all that together, this is not the best recipe for success. But it is what adolescence is, and it is what we have to deal with. And I think if we recognize that it's as tumultuous at times for the parents as it is for the teenagers, and maybe we can all take a deep breath and relax a little bit and realize that what's going on may in fact be in large part quite normal, I think everybody's anxiety can come down a little bit, and maybe we can focus on what the teenagers really need to become young and strong adults, which I assume most parents really want. We're going to expand on that a little bit in a few minutes. All right. But I want to be clear that this independent identity remains tied in most cases to the actual family members and in all cases to the unconscious representations of the parenting figures from infancy to childhood. This is an object relational assumption of mental functioning, that we are the sum total of the parental experiences, of identifications with the parenting figures, that our identity becomes slowly built up in the accumulation of these experiences, some good, some not so good. The sum total of these things is how we get to be the men and women we are. And we are social creatures by evolutionary development or the grace of God, and our identities may remain grounded in the experience of nurturing care we had as children. It also remains grounded in those experiences where care failed to provide the developmentally appropriate focus on the child's needs. Adolescents experience development both in terms of the three above factors and in the present and their unique childhood development that laid down the fundamental elements of their character structure and defenses. So what I'm trying to do here is unfortunately complicated. There are layers of meaning here. There's layers of accumulated experience, both good and bad and somewhere in the middle. And that to understand adolescent development and to understand adult development and to understand the interaction between adults and their adolescents, one has to take a conscious effort to remember the childhood dynamics, because they're there. And when adolescents act out, when there are problems and conflicts, one cannot simply look at the phenomenology of the adolescent experience in the here and now. You must ask the question, what is the meaning of this behavior? You cannot just look at the behavior and slap a diagnostic label on it. It has to be understood in the context of the child's entire development and in the context of the entire family's experience from birth on. Now, I also want some balance here. We can't get lost in the past. One of the mistakes therapists make, I think, is spending too much time trying to generate a detailed history. Most of what we need to know is in front of us, happening in front of us. The experience of the adolescent in front of us is giving us most of what we know. A detailed history is important, but we can't get lost in it. I want to add a third component. Not surprisingly, there's the present, there's the past. Let me think, what else? Oh yeah, the future. The goal of all of this work is to ensure that young adults enter their adulthood with the ability to make adult-level, responsible, mature decisions about love, about relationships, about their own family and potential children, work, creativity, all of these things. So the adolescent development I'm talking about focuses on the childhood and family past, the current situation, which usually is what it begins with, but also keeps an eye on where these children are going and what they need to get there. Let me say a few words about identity. I think that phrase gets thrown around a little too much, and it's not as clear as it needs to be. It's a little like the phrase self-esteem. We all hear that all the time, but nobody spends enough time actually describing what that is. Same thing with identity. All right, here's the best quote I've ever heard. Pardon me for reading a little too much, perhaps. It's from Lichtenstein. Quote, "Man can assume, compared to most animals, an almost infinite variety of behavioral identities. He is near protean in his behavioral character, a fact which enables him to adapt himself to almost any environmental change. For his adaptability, however, he is forever threatened with loss or breakdown of his identity, a danger unknown to the animal under natural conditions. Man has forever to struggle with the need to define himself, to create an identity not basically inherent in him by dint of inborn automatisms." What does this mean? A lot of technical sounding jargon there, but it's absolutely right and crucial to understand. A lion is a lion is a lion and has been a lion for a million years or so. They always do the same thing. They raise their kids in the same way. They're in the same environment, and they can't survive anywhere else. That's obvious. But look at people. Humans have conquered the planet in every possible environment. We don't have that kind of an identity. Either, again, by the grace of Darwin and evolution or the grace of God, we have an adaptive brain that has allowed us to evolve an adaptive flexibility to various environments, a huge frontal lobe capable of abstract reasoning, memory, language, the communication of ideas, the accumulation of knowledge and wisdom, and then, of course, technologies to promote it, and boom, we've conquered the planet. That adaptivity, that lack of rigid animal-like character structure or identity, is both the strength that has allowed us to conquer the planet and a very real threatening problem, because we don't have, as Lichtenstein said, an animal-like consistency. So we are forever having to create an identity, and it's not a process that ever comes to an end. I mean, that's part of what's fascinating about therapy. That's why therapy is even possible. Change is forever a possibility. I've had patients in their mid to late 60s. There is a whole subspecialty in psychology, geriatric psychology. I have a colleague who was treating several women in their 70s and one in their early 80s. It's beautiful when it works. It's beautiful when there's enough courage to try to make changes even late in life. And that's a great thing, but it does leave adolescents and adults sometimes vulnerable to the collapse of an identity that has to be not only built up, but maintained. Is never really secure that if there's enough trauma, anyone can suffer a breakdown. And even if you think you're consistent, we are biological creatures that are either getting stronger or sometimes physiologically getting weaker, especially with an aging population. And so our identities are always at risk and always have the potential for growth and strengthening and development. If ever there was a two-edged sword, this is it. Are there consistencies? Well, of course, we're not random. We did evolve or were created to be a kind of creature, and we can't become whatever we want. Our ability to change is within fairly stringent biological limits. We are sexual and aggressive creatures by genetic nature, and while we are very flexible, I think the sort of postmodern philosophies that have been out there that simply have thrown off any reality-based restrictions are symptomatic. I think there's something grossly wrong with someone who, in almost a delusional way, thinks that reality doesn't matter. Reality will always win in the end, and our ideologies and philosophies will succumb to reality at some point or another. So I'm trying to sort of hem in the extremes of that protean potential that Lichtenstein talks about, while trying to expand the core of that to its limits. I hope that makes some sense. Back to adolescent development. It seems that the experience of identity in the adolescent isn't just a disruption in a normal progression. Trees get acorn seeds get planted, and out of them grow great oak trees. There isn't any point in time when the oak tree has an identity crisis. It just grows up to be an oak tree if the circumstances and the environment are adequate to its needs. It appears that in adolescence, there feels like a crisis of identity that's worthy of the name crisis. And the question for therapists is, how grave is that crisis? What is it? Is it real? Is it a thing? What is normal in terms of adolescent development? And I have to say that in my research, my field is split on this rather seriously. I almost want to say comically. Traditionally, psychoanalysis has held that adolescence is a time of the reemergence of pre-Oedipal and pre-genital splitting processes that throw the self into turmoil because of the intensely growing sexual demands of the body, reawaken polymorphously perverse infantile sexual dynamics prior to the development of adequate ego strength to contain and control them. I'm sorry, but that's one of the reasons people don't like psychoanalytic theory much anymore. but it's true, it turns out. What is this saying? That what happens in the adolescent is, as I sort of generally alluded to before, there's an eruption of very primitive infantile feelings. And I challenge anybody to look at a baby for more than 5 minutes, especially when they're crying. What is happening inside the baby's mind when they're crying? And I don't mean just a little boo-hoo-hoo. I mean when a baby is in full cry mode. If you look carefully, if you actually experience, if you're available emotionally to the experience of the baby, what you see without question is an unmistakable experience of hell. That the baby is terrified, the baby is enraged, the baby is suffering. They're screaming, red-faced, muscular tension, they're howling in pain. And they have the psychic equivalent of that terror, of that trauma in them that becomes part of their accumulated experience. And guess what, folks? In adolescence, some of that old, long repressed adolescent frustration gets reawakened through the physical hormonal development of the body and the brain. We have adolescents who can access some pretty primitive stuff and do not yet have the containing ability, what the old school calls adequate ego strength, to manage and control those feelings. So we get some disruptive behavior. In addition, Meltzer says, hence, the adolescent's gross incapacity to fulfill commitments together, to carry through resolutions of his own, or to comprehend why he cannot be entrusted with responsibilities of an adult nature. That sound familiar? I suspect it does. Anna Freud, a long time ago, laid out a long paragraph, which I wish to read, that I think almost artistically lays out the dilemma for parents as well as the adolescents themselves. When she talked about, quote, the incomprehensible and irreconcilable contradictions then apparent in the psychic life of adolescents. Adolescents are excessively egoistic, regarding themselves as the center of the universe and the sole object of interest. And yet at no time in later life are they capable of so much self-sacrifice and devotion. They form the most passionate love relations only to break them off as abruptly as they began them. On the one hand, they throw themselves enthusiastically into the life of the community, and on the other, they have an overpowering longing for solitude. They oscillate between blind submission to some self-chosen leader and defiant rebellion against any and every authority. They are selfish and materially minded, and at the same time full of lofty idealism. They are ascetic, but will suddenly plunge into instinctual indulgence of the most primitive character. At times, their behavior to other people is rough and inconsiderate, and yet they themselves are extremely touchy. Their moods veer between lighthearted optimism and the blackest pessimism. Sometimes they will work with indefatigable enthusiasm, and at other times they are sluggish and apathetic. And what I find amazing about that beautiful quote is that both of those perspectives are true without contradiction. That doesn't make any sense. It doesn't seem logical. What we have here are contradictions, differences that seem quite extreme. No, this is the adolescent's mental state ongoing. There is no contradiction here. Both of these things can be true, one right after the other or simultaneously. It doesn't make sense. It's not logical. Welcome to adolescent development. There is an opposing view. And like I said, my field is split. So here's the opposing view. From Santrock. Indeed, for most adolescents, adolescence is not a time of rebellion, crisis, pathology, or deviance. A far more accurate vision of adolescence is that it is a time of evaluation, decision-making, commitment, and carving out a place in the world. It is an enormous error, though, to confuse adolescents' enthusiasm for trying on new identities and enjoying moderate amounts of outrageous behavior with hostility toward parental and societal standards. Acting out and boundary testing are time-honored ways in which adolescents move toward accepting rather than rejecting parental values. And I'm going to say again, in the big picture, those two very different ways of thinking about the adolescent experience are not in contradiction. Both those things can be true. And here's why. The level of traumatic acting out or calm maturing during adolescence is directly related to the level of nurturing care in childhood and the quality of parenting both then and during the adolescent's teenage years. That's what makes it one or the other. Chaos and turbulence in teenagers is a direct derivative of parental pathology. They are always rebelling against the differential between prior idealizations, and that means the image that the parents have fostered in the child's mind of the parents, and the reality they are coming to see more clearly, the way the parents have failed them. Rebellion as teenagers, sometimes highly aggressive, is developmentally necessary if the parents fail to care for the children adequately. They cannot continue to idealize failed parents, and the shock of this realization is more traumatic for the adolescent, and therefore, of course, calling for more rebellious, more extreme responses to that failure than for the parents who do not see their own contributions to the problem. Anna Freud once said that if we see a polite teenager, we see a sick teenager. This may be true if the politeness has been purchased at the cost of submission and blind obedience, and therefore the sacrifice of the teenager's own identity. Neither submission nor violent rebellion is normal in teenage development. That's the question. Neither of those. A polite teenager, a submissive, obedient teenager, may have been coerced or threatened into it by over-impinging, aggressive, hostile, sometimes violent parents. Teenagers that act out destructively may be pulling away from what they perceive as an abusive dynamic they can no longer tolerate. There's usually some grain of truth in the teenager's rebellion. Now, back to the middle, I hope. Conflict and attachment. Connection to the parents and conflict and separation and moves toward autonomy. Part of the problem is that while stress occurs throughout the entire course of human development, no question about that, it does not occur with the adolescent's unique combination of physical, psychological, environmental, social, and cultural factors all happening at once. There is, in some cases, a witch's brew of dynamics coming within the teenager, coming from without, the family, the culture, and it does seem to generate some conflict that seems extreme. We have to be able to tease apart the adolescent's behavior. We cannot just look at the adolescent's behavior. It tells us nothing. Why is the adolescent behaving that way? Is it a family dynamic? Is it a cultural dynamic? Is it biological, hormonal? Is it something that he or she is getting from the peer group? Is it some combination of all of these things in various doses which we must tease apart to be able to interact, certainly as a therapist, to be able to provide a context for healing, for cure, for development? If we don't get those as factors, we're not going to be able to help the patient. If you don't understand the patient's entire context, you cannot diagnose the problem accurately. If you cannot diagnose the problem, you cannot solve the problem. And I think there is this extra dynamic on the part of the parents. I think most adults repress most of the memory of their own semi-turbulent adolescence. And they find adolescence kind of irritating and troublesome sometimes, in part, I think, because they've projected some of their own now forgotten repressed dynamics onto them. Things about themselves they never liked, things about themselves that were wounded or hurt or unpleasant, they put them on, they get rid of them, splitting and projection, common defense mechanisms for all of us. I think if parents could spend some time with a little more sensitive memory of their own experiences, they might not respond so aggressively to their own children's inevitably similar acting out. My hope is that these lectures will provide a remedy to that exact problem. We must look at the big picture of adolescent development, and we must look at the deeper, longer picture of the adult development that leads to the kind of conflict. It takes two to tango in adult and adolescent conflict, always. and the adults have been doing that dance a lot longer. So my sense is the responsibility, not the blame, but the responsibility lies with the parents to come to the dynamic with as clean a set of hands as they can. What that means simply is with as a deep emotional awareness of their own issues as they can find the courage to muster. Okay, a little cultural commentary. The central flaw in the argument that I've just laid out about adolescent development and whether or not it is supposed to be placid and normal and smooth, or whether it's tumultuous and aggressive and hostile, I think the problem with that lies in the cultural reality that our civilization seems to be unraveling. As clinicians, we see what I cannot call other than the catastrophic destruction of the nuclear family and its immediate effect on child development. This is going to be hard to hear. Divorce is child abuse. There is no way around that. There is no way to call it anything else. I'm going to spend a fair amount of time later on the exact dynamics in child abuse. The short version is it tears the child's mind. Divorce tears the child's mind apart. And I think it's fair. I think it's right based on my experience with my adolescent patients, most of whom are the children of divorce. I think it's fair to say that divorce to the children is child abuse, whatever the parents think of it. There's a separate issue, and this one's difficult and painful, and the source in my field of a great deal of hostility, anger, resentment, almost rage, but I cannot avoid it. The single most powerful correlational element in teenage mental illness, premature sexual acting out, teenage pregnancy, drug use, criminality, imprisonment, and poverty is being from a single parent household. Painful, but that fact is no longer disputable. Federal statistics on this issue are no longer meaningfully in dispute. No amount of ideological outrage can contest the reality on the ground that single parenting is consistently associated, consistently correlated with catastrophic adolescent outcomes. Are there single parents who can raise healthy children? Sure, I know lots of them. But the overwhelming evidence is that it is a steep and difficult and more often than not unsuccessful effort, whatever the political aspirations, whatever the ideologies of the people involved. It doesn't work very well, it turns out. And I have to suggest that this is where reality has to come in. Freud was right about maturity being a function of our ability to manage more and more reality. Even the philosopher Nietzsche said, "How much truth can you endure?" That being the test of adulthood. And so I have heard one too many times, I'm afraid, in the context of divorce, parents telling the children, "Oh, this will be better for everyone." And the answer is no, that's a lie. That's a damn lie. It's never better for the children, virtually. What would be better for the children would if the parents got some help, grew up emotionally, reestablished perhaps established for the first time an honest, loving relationship, and maintained a home where the children's mind could grow and where love could dominate over hate. That would be good for everybody. Divorce is never good for the children. I'll say this again later, perhaps. Divorce is the price children pay for parental failure. I see no way around that conclusion given the data, the clinical experience that I and my colleagues see on a daily basis, not to mention the federal statistics on the matter. What are we going to do about that? I am not a glass half empty kind of guy. I want to be positive about this. The answer is to look at what children and adolescents need, what adults need. What are those needs developmentally in the context that they're in now? And how can parents meet those needs, whatever the circumstances are, whatever the past adult parental decisions have been, whatever the adult's developmental dislocations themselves are, can everybody move? Because we're flexible, because we're evolved to be creative, adaptive creatures, can we use that possibility? And can adults do that as well, to move into a place where all of our needs can be met and we can begin to find more love than frustration and hate? The danger is that as a culture, we're not doing that. It appears to me unmistakable that clinicians, the research seems to bear this out. There's too much to deny it. Clinicians are now seeing an increase, a notable increase, in the prevalence of the more severe narcissistic and borderline types of character organization. Those more primitive mental, lack of mental structures, those more severe personality disorders, are associated with intolerance to frustration and conflict, impulsivity, the need for more immediate and direct gratification, an impaired or limited capacity for sustained human relationships. If we can't turn the tide on this, we're looking at a fragmentation of the basic cultural prerequisites for healthy adult living at all, much less healthy adolescent development in the context of that social dynamic. The end result is, if our culture is somewhat unraveling, it's more important than ever for the adult parents in the family dynamic to recognize that, take a deep breath, and do the best they can where they are, in spite of that stuff. What are we going to do? Quit? Take our ball and go home? There is no going home. We are home. And if our home is a bit chaotic, then we need to fix that. Fix wherever we are. I like that old saying about, think globally, act locally. Fine. Let's act locally. And by locally, I don't mean political activism like that. I mean act locally within our present nuclear family to be better than we have been. That is our responsibility. I don't think we can change the world. Kumbaya. I don't think so. But I think we do have both the power and the responsibility to fix our little section of it. And that is my hope for these lectures. Here's the danger if we don't, by Spiegel. If law-abiding society does not offer the adolescent adequate ego ideals in the form of heroic figures, his hunger for them will tend to drive him to the gang. For the gang represents a social organization that takes care of the functional, instinctual, and value disturbances of adolescent in conveniently institutionalized ways. And if you've been paying attention for more than 5 minutes to the current situation in the United States, we have in most of our inner cities not a gun problem, we have a gang problem. Gangs now are the source of the majority of homicides in this country. I don't think that's an arguable statistical fact now. And so I think what we're seeing is a manifestation of those failures of family dynamics. And we are now on notice. This is the direction we're heading. And I would like to do my part to fix it. And I'm challenging parents to recognize the direction we're going, recognize the direction they themselves have been launched into by their parents, and say, enough with the intergenerational transmission of trauma. It stops with us. It stops here. The hope for the future is always in the hands of the healthy young. If they're healthy, it is the work of the parents to ensure that their children are healthy. And again, it's the purpose of this series of lectures to give the parents the tools to succeed regardless of the social context, regardless of what's come before, and regardless, frankly, of what decisions the parents have made up to now. We are flexible. We can fix our mistakes. And my challenge to you is to take a deep breath, look at this material carefully and honestly, look inside yourselves and your family dynamics, and do so. It is never too late. Let me go back. The danger of our species is that we don't have a necessary identity. The hope for our species is that the identity that we do have is not locked in concrete. And I for one, am going to remain hopeful that with a bit of intelligent and appropriate and emotionally sensitive intervention, we can fix these things. Let's take a short break now. I'll come back to section 2, normal development, in just a minute.